You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, another bad day at the White House.
You know, I'm not going to speak for Sean in detail. I can say that he understood that the president wanted to bring in and add new people to the team, and Sean felt like it would be best for that team to be able to start with a totally clean slate.
Donald Trump's press spokesman Sean Spicer resigns 6 months after he started by shouting at the press. We'll explore why, as well as looking at the growing battle between the Trump team and the special counsel investigating them. More violence in Venezuela as a general strike gathers pace. Later we'll get the latest from Caracas. And we'll find out too what it's like to work with fashion star turned film director Tom Ford.
His intelligence is so broad in terms of art and photography and architecture that and film that it was very easy to have these conversations with him about these reference points. Because once you have those shared reference points, it's very easy to sort of talk about how these spaces should feel and how they should work.
Plus, why has the latest big-budget HBO blockbuster caused so much trouble? We'll find out about the dystopian drama that's reviving America's embarrassing past. All that in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Before that, though, let's take a look at some of the day's other top news stories. A pro-Brexit member of Britain's government has said it is united in believing there must be a transitional period once the country leaves the European Union. Michael Gove, who was one of the leading pro-Brexit campaigners last year, says there will be a period where EU citizens would still have the right to live and work in the UK after the scheduled date of departure from the Union in 2019. Palestinian officials say three people have been killed in clashes with security forces in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Hundreds of people were injured in violence which followed days of growing tension over security measures at a holy site in Jerusalem. That followed the killing of two Israeli policemen a week ago. The US is to ban its citizens from travelling to North Korea. Officials are linking the decision to the death of Otto Warmbier, the student who was jailed by the regime in Pyongyang. The ban means that U.S. citizens will need special authorization to travel to or inside North Korea. And three Chinese warships are in the Baltic to join Russian naval exercises in the region. It's the first time China has joined exercises in that area. NATO is closely monitoring their activities after boosting the alliance's defenses in the Baltic states. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. Now, it was on the second day of the Trump administration that people started to question exactly how long Sean Spicer could survive as White House press secretary. It turns out the answer to that question was almost exactly 6 months. Sean Spicer resigned today after Donald Trump appointed a close ally as communications director. In a moment, we'll cross to our New York bureau. But first, let's take a look back at some of the highlights of Sean Spicer's all-too-brief career at the White House.
And you don't get to just yell out questions. We're going to raise our hand like big boys and girls.
Cancel in the daily press briefings.
I think he's a little dismayed, as well as a lot of people, that we come out here and try to do everything we can to provide you and the American people with what he's doing on their behalf, and yet we see time and time again an attempt to parse every little word and make it more of a game of gotcha, as opposed to really figure out what the policies are.
If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection.
Someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
I mean, just the other day, he sat down with Martin Luther King Jr. I would call him a civil rights leader.
Where his dad was the civil
third.
Rights leader.
Well, I think that...
You've had the House Intelligence Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee.
No, actually, here's his quote, Jonathan. No, here's the direct quote. I think it's very possible, end quote. And we talked about wiretapping. He meant surveillance.
Well, so you're coming to some serious conclusions.
I think the president's tweets stand for themselves. I think there's a huge appetite for tax reform.
Have a great weekend.
How we will miss him. Well, Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, has been across this through the day. He joins me now. Ed, I mean, we always thought Sean Spicer was going to get fired. In the end, he quit, but it's pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
We did think that, you know, we thought that he wasn't going to be around forever. We didn't think he was going to survive that long. I mean, let's be honest, as those clips you just played, he's been embattled for a very, very long time. He started out in this combative role from the very beginning when he defended, of course, the crowd sizes at the inauguration and kind of went on from there. He didn't look entirely comfortable, you know, standing behind that podium and having to defend so many of Donald Trump's actions, and often, you know, message something that was ended up being, you know, ended up conflicting with what Donald Trump would later tweet. You know, Donald Trump took to kind of having a go at Sean Spicer. He let it be known that he wasn't entirely happy with the communications in the White House. And we saw that in his media interviews. We saw that in the fact that he really did something rather mean. And it's hard not to feel sorry for Sean Spicer, a devout Catholic, on Donald Trump's visit to the Vatican back in May. He was snubbed from that visit. You know, Donald Trump took all his family and left Sean Spicer behind. So one of the ways he was snubbed, he'd been operating in this kind of Jew role since just 3 months ago when Mike Dubko, who was the communications director, quit. And so Sean Spicer was press secretary and also communications director, and perhaps he was hoping that he might become a fully-fledged communications director. But we saw, certainly in the last few weeks, and even more so as more press briefings had been off-camera, that he was, you know, taking an increased back role. We don't know if that was a snub or just because he was also handling this due role as communications director, but it does seem that he was kind of being edged out. And people are questioning, you know, when he was snubbed on so many occasions, when Donald Trump said things about him in public, he still remained loyal and really decided to resign at the very, very last moment when he could have perhaps done it earlier and made more of a statement.
Now, in recent weeks, he'd almost disappeared. The briefings were being conducted off camera, usually being done by his deputy. And Sean Spicer, as we say, has been subjected to ridicule, those Saturday Night Live impressions. As you mentioned, that nonsensical first briefing about the size of the inauguration crowd, the terrible fiasco over Covfefe. Yeah, his briefings have been a huge hit for all the wrong reasons. To be fair to him, who on earth could successfully sell the kind of stuff that Spicer's been told to sell to the press and the public?
I mean, they've become a spectacle. I mean, never really has the press briefing been such requisite viewing for anyone interested in Washington politics. I mean, literally all the cable news channels have been excited about being able to air it every day. Interestingly or bizarrely, the statement that was read out today from Donald Trump said, just look at his great television ratings. I mean, he actually mentioned that when he was saying goodbye, as it were, to Sean Spicer. Who can defend this? Well, that's a good question. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is now the new press secretary. She was, of course, deputy under Spicer and had been taking an ever more prominent role during those briefings. She seems to be getting better. I'd say that she still has a combative role. You know, she still sees the media as fake news. She's still prepared to kind of take them on. What was interesting, I guess, today was seeing Anthony Scaramucci, the new communications director, appearing before cameras. Now, obviously, one of the big reasons that Sean Spicer was resigned was that he was vehemently opposed to the nomination of Scaramucci, who is a Trump loyalist, a former banker. He's apparently not the only one. Reince Priebus is apparently opposed, as is Steve Bannon. So there's some discord over this nomination of this New Yorker that it really, in many ways, is cut from a similar cloth than Donald Trump.
Why are they so opposed to him? Is it just his connections to Trump?
Well, there's some questions over some conflicts of interest due to his previous financial dealings, as it were. Secondly, certainly from the point of view of Sean Spicer, although he's very, presentable, as it were, on television, he does not have any sort of experience heading up communications. So that was a big concern for Spicer. But, you know, seeing him on TV today, he was eloquent. He did get on there and he talked about sort of bringing back a sort of sense of calm. He's talked about reducing tension and anxiety with the press. And we'll have to see if that actually happens, if there is going to be a change of tack. Because, you know, let's face it, over the last few weeks and even going back months, even from that first initial press briefing, it's been an antagonistic environment on both sides. The press feeling that they're besieged and the White House believing that the press is not getting across their message they're trying to convey. Now, Scaramucci is a fighter as well. We've seen that in his past and his career. So I don't know, when he's under the spotlight for a long time, when questions keep coming, we'll have to see if he turns into a more fighting mode. Of course, he won't always be on television. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going to be the most visible face of the White House, but it'll be interesting to see how he kind of fits into this position and also how he kind of gels or not with some of the strong personalities, like I mentioned, like Bannon and Priebus, already at the heart of the White House.
One has to ask about Sean Spicer's future. I presume he's not exactly going to be short of offers of work.
And you'd think so. And one of the bizarre things that Scaramucci said today when he was talking from the podium was that I hope he goes on to make a tremendous amount of money. I think we might see the kind of shackles that have seemed to be locked to Sean Spicer over the last few weeks removed. Although he's obviously probably bitterly disappointed about what's happened to his Washington career, I think he's probably going to be relieved to be free of that. And I'm sure, yes, there will be a whole host of offers. We'll have to see how open he is about talking about his time under Donald Trump, given the fact that he has been and still is being extremely loyal to the president of the US.
Maybe he could sign up for a guest host spot on Saturday Night Live. Monocle's New York bureau chief there, Ed Stocker. You're with Monocle 24. We'll stick with Donald Trump in just a moment.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
While Sean Spicer was signing his resignation letter, the special counsel investigating the alleged links between Donald Trump's presidential campaign and Russia had another request for the White House. Robert Mueller's team wants every single message related to Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer to be preserved. That includes emails, text messages, even voicemails. This latest move comes as the president's lawyers and aides pore over the backgrounds of the investigators hired by Mueller. So is this the start of a journey that ends with Trump firing the man investigating him? Well, let's discuss that now with David Osborne, who's chief US commentator at The Independent. David, they are looking at the past clients these investigators have had. They're looking at possible donations to Democrat candidates in past elections. And presumably the idea is to build up a case to say this is a group of people with a prior grudge against Donald Trump.
Yes, that's right. They're trying to undermine Robert Mueller even before he's actually almost started his investigation. And so it's a sign, you know, that the White House and Donald Trump are nervous. They have taken particular umbrage at indications that Robert Mueller is going to widen the investigation into some of Donald Trump's financial doings in the past, possibly even delving into those famous tax returns that none of the rest of us have seen. And so, in typical Trump fashion, I think, he's decided not just to sit back and wait for the shoes to drop from Mueller's office, but to go on to the attack straight away.
He did this interview in the New York Times a few days ago where he talked about some of the people in Mueller's team had potential conflicts of interest, that he shouldn't stray beyond the mandate that he's been given. As you say, he's getting his attack in before the investigation's really started.
Yes, he is. He's being extremely aggressive. And this is ringing a lot of alarm bells. I think that some people see that what's happening here is Trump is not just looking to, I think, intimidate the Mueller team in some way or fashion, but possibly lay the groundwork down the road to fire Robert Mueller. Again, that wouldn't be out of character for Mr. Trump. As you've just heard, he's already lost his spokesman today. However, that would set off, I think, a very serious constitutional crisis in Washington. A number of members on the Hill, Republican and Democrat, have indicated that that would be an extremely unwelcome move. And who knows what kind of tsunami of criticism and subsequent actions that would unleash. And in the meantime, Paul, we're also hearing through reports, and mostly in the Washington Post, which is interesting also, that Donald Trump has been exploring with his legal team what his options might be to pardon those people around him in the White House, and potentially even pardon himself, which is also interesting and a little bit disturbing. But I guess he sees that as another weapon to reach for if the worst comes to the worst. Anyway, it looks like it's going to be an extremely confrontational summer in Washington, D.C.
A cynic might argue that a president under investigation who then investigates whether he can pardon himself is kind of inviting a presumption of guilt.
It does rather sound like that, doesn't it? It's interesting also that when he was talking about why Robert Mueller shouldn't expand his investigation into his financial dealings, he said, you know, I have nothing, no history of doing business with Russia, none at all. But if he happens to stumble across something about Russians buying my condos, well, you know, he shouldn't. So once again, you're like, oh, so that's what he's worried about. So indeed, by doing some of these things with these leaks that are coming out of the White House, it does rather compound the impression of a president who is angry, frustrated, but also feeling a little cornered and possibly a little scared of what's coming down the pike. And a scared Donald Trump could be a dangerous thing indeed.
David, thank you very much. That's David Osborne from The Independent in New York. You're with The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Now, at least four people, among them a 15-year-old boy, have been killed in the latest anti-government demonstrations in Venezuela. Opposition activists claim that millions of people joined the walkouts protesting against the president, Nicolas Maduro. He is under increasing pressure to cancel elections to an assembly that his critics say is just a front to bypass opposing voices. Well, for the latest, we can join Monocle's correspondent in Caracas now, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, there were more large-scale demonstrations today, more violent. Too. What has been happening?
Well, yesterday actually was a national strike, not a protest, Paul. So from the Amazon all the way to the Colombian border, millions took part in a strike against President Maduro's plan, to, as you say, to rewrite the constitution. Swathes of the capital, Caracas, where I am, became a ghost town well into the afternoon as main roads were deserted or barricaded. It was a civil strike, not a general strike, and therefore individual employees and owners could choose whether to take part, which was where the opposition that called the strike was unsure how many would actually get on board. And so instead of working, Venezuelans yesterday set out furniture, piles of rubbish and burning debris at road junctions to stop vehicles. And that's where we saw this sort of standoff between security forces and those taking part.
So what is it about this assembly that so annoys Maduro's opponents?
I think the main thing, I mean, well, once such an assembly has actually finished its job of redrafting the constitution, it is essentially dissolved. I mean, that's what happened in post-partition India, for example, or in Italy after the Second World War. But what Mr. Maduro has not said is when or even if this assembly would ever be dissolved. So his opponents fear it could become sort of a long-term fixture, that he sort of supersedes the democratically elected parliament. And they also fear that the new assembly's remit will go way beyond simply sort of tweaking the constitution, and that it will basically just rubber stamp the president's orders. So Cuba under Fidel Castro comes to mind.
So facing these strikes and demonstrations, what has Maduro been saying?
Well, yesterday, Mr. Maduro in his speech said that some of those who led the strike would be jailed, and insisted actually that the strike action was minimal. He boasted that some 700 leading food businesses, i.e. foreign-run kiosks and little sort of news agents, for example, were still working. He also actually used his official Twitter account to post a video yesterday afternoon on strike day of him driving around government buildings with his wife in Caracas, saying that in every corner of the country, people went out to walk or went out to work. But he's driving around the block of government ministries, which is obviously hardly representative. And he also retweeted images of people queuing outside state-run banks. But I've heard from critics that the only reason why there were queues yesterday outside the banks that were open is because the government actually changed the date that retirees could withdraw their state pension. So they changed it to Thursday to make it look like business was running as normal. So he's just insisted that the constituent assembly will go ahead and that things are running as normal.
Now, the US has said that it would consider what it called swift economic action if this election went ahead. Now, the US is Venezuela's biggest trading partner. It's very reliant on it. So what impact does that have?
Well, yes, as you say, President Trump did say on Monday he threatened to take economic action, which would directly, I mean, considering that Venezuela exports, I think it's 700,000 barrels of crude per day, it would have a significant impact on Venezuela's ability to function, although it's completely dysfunctional at the minute. But President Maduro has said he'll proceed with a July 30 vote, despite what the government has called a brutal interventionist threat from the U.S. But some argue that actually sanctions from the U.S. would hurt Venezuelans first and actually the most vulnerable. So it's a difficult one.
And presumably that those who are opposed to this plan to maintain these protests right up to the scheduled date of the election.
Yes, indeed. And another actual strike is planned next week. And there were nods to a possible march on the presidential palace in Miraflores, which, if it happens, would echo events 15 years ago in the run-up to a short-lived coup against Hugo Chavez, Maduro's predecessor. So tension's very high. And the opposition, alongside the people of Venezuela, really, have insisted that pressure will build. Many I spoke to yesterday are hoping that actually it doesn't get to the date of the Constituent Assembly and that some sort of negotiation takes place before next Sunday. But so far, Maduro is adamant that he'll go through with the vote.
Lucinda, thank you. Well, earlier, Lucinda was out meeting some of the people who are participating in that strike. One of the people she spoke to was Enrique, who's from Altamira, a district to the east of Caracas. Here is a little of what he had to say.
We are out here today supporting the call to strike because we want this corrupt government full of drug traffickers to go. A government that has left our country more bankrupt than we've ever seen before. Look right here. There is a business that is always open, but today it is shut. They are supporting the strike today. There are many businesses that closed. Very few are open. Everyone wants Maduro to go. There is no secret. All of us, more than 90% of the population, want him to go. Seriously, even those aligned with Chavez want Nicolas Maduro to go. There are many who want him to go because the country is living in indefinite misery.
Sí, en serio, porque todos los que eran partidarios de Chávez, también hay muchos que quieren que se vaya, pues, porque tienen país.
I hope that we don't have to wait until July 30th. It's a personal opinion, but I hope we don't, and that something happens before that day. I hope Maduro goes before then.
Digamos, claro, una opinión muy personal, pero yo espero que no lleguemos a esa fecha.
That's Enrique, one of the protesters in Venezuela. And thanks also to Monocle's Lucinda Elliott, who joined us from Caracas. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, change was at the heart of Emmanuel Macron's campaign for the French presidency, and he has given a clear signal that he won't tolerate anybody who stands in his way. But the resignation of France's military chief in a row over budget cuts has focused attention on the emerging style of the Macron presidency. Well, joining me in the studio is Marie Billon, who's a UK-based correspondent for French media. Marie, this has made big news in France, the resignation of this general saying that he cannot deliver the defences that France needs under the new president. What's led to it?
Well, basically, so it's been in the news when he resigned, but he's been on the news before that because there was a big public row between this top general and the president. Before the 14th of July, there was kind of an audition inside the Assemblée Nationale, so the equivalent of the House of Commons, like a select committee. And the top general, Pierre de Villiers, said that in very flourish term, that basically he wouldn't accept the cuts that was imposed by the new president. And after that, the president said very publicly that if the top general himself had different views on some topic, the top general will have to change his views. So it was very public. And on the 14th of July, you know, it's the celebration of the army and this kind of thing, it was all the more public because the two men were together. Everybody was talking about that. And then a few days later, the top general decided to resign. Basically, for a few days, it was obvious that the two men couldn't work together. We were waiting to see who's going to bend the knee first. And it had to be, of course, the general. And there was the whole question of, was it staged in a way? Because the general, some say, journalists say, he knew that what was said inside the select committee would be out, and he, as I said, I won't repeat what he said because that's something that can't be said on radio, I think. But he knew that this kind of language would be basically going out of the Assemblée Nationale. So was it basically on purpose? Did he want to make a stand in a way to see how this new man would react to what we call la grande muette, so the big silent lady, which is the army? Will the president, who needs the army to protect the people on the street at the moment, not just far away in
Africa, because there is still a state of emergency.
Still a state of emergency. So the president is still relying very much on the army. So it was kind of a test of strength, some say, against the president. And if strength there was to be seen, he showed strength.
So to Macron's critics, this is arrogance, this is hoarding of power, this is refusing to listen to opposing voices. But presumably it was the public discontent with the ruling class in France that propelled Macron into this job. So he may well feel that he has a mandate to do exactly this kind of thing.
Well, very objectively, he has. He's the chief of the army, so he can not do whatever he wants, but he's the one setting the agenda. If he says, I'm going to cut the budget of the army has to accept that the budget is to be cut. That's very objectively what's happening and what should happen. The way it was done was a bit special in a way, but the fact that some people said, at last, we have a president who can make a decision. I mean, we had François Hollande for 5 years who couldn't make a decision, who was not a strong man, or didn't have the face of a strong man anyway, and didn't prove he was a strong man during 5 years he was in office. And now, less than 5 months after he's in office, he's so strong that he's been criticized for that. So that's kind of a big change for French people at the moment. And of course, I mean, it's at the moment, the army being used as it's being used to protect the people on the street, and it's still a state of emergency. All the opposition to Emmanuel Macron is using this story to try and show that he's not the liberal, nice guy that he's presented himself to be. He's a very tough politician. He's a very, very stern man, and he is very authoritative man. And this is supposed to basically have unveiled the real face of Emmanuel Macron, according to the far left as well as the far right. So there's a kind of an agreement on the strategy to adopt to try and diminish the honeymoon state, or stop the honeymoon state of the president, which is already fading away because it's not the first time.
I was going to ask about that, because obviously all new leaders have a honeymoon period, with the possible exception of Donald Trump. And so is the honeymoon fading with the voters, or is it just with the other politicians?
Well, it's a bit hard to say, because it hasn't been, of course, a big consultation of the voters. But some people in Emmanuel Macron's camp are already leaving the boat. We see that, for example, the one who was a spokesperson, who used to be a journalist in the US, she was a spokesperson of Emmanuel Macron during the campaign. She decided to go back to the US officially because she just wanted to go back. But she also said that there are sides of Emmanuel Macron that she didn't like. And there are some people who think that, even some journalists, Emmanuel Macron, it was a shooting star. In 1 year, he was from not non-entity, but not someone who could win the presidency, to someone who basically had won the presidency. So the journalists didn't have much time to figure out who he was, and his communication was very strict. So some people say we are discovering the real Emmanuel Macron now, and they say we've been discovering him since he shown the way he wanted to be president. And the first major thing he did in terms of imposing his style was welcoming Vladimir Putin in Versailles, and then having in Versailles as well the two chambers and dressing the two chambers, which is something that normally is not done unless there's a crisis in the country. So from then already, there was already this idea that perhaps Emmanuel Macron is really want to take advantage of what the Constitution of France permits, which is that the president can be a Republican monarch in a way. And this is something that people don't really like. Some people don't really like, because the far left has really risen during this election. And the far left wants a sixth republic. We are in the fifth republic. They want a sixth republic because they don't want such power to be in the hands of just one man, who is the president. So knowing that there was this rise in the wish of a sixth republic, the fact that as soon as he arrived, he decided to use completely all the powers that the Constitution gave him, already made people talk a lot. And even those who were very much in favor of him were thinking, yes, maybe that's something we didn't expect of him. We want him to be firm and authoritative, but is he trying to basically promote himself a little too much? Does he realize in a way that he doesn't have to prove himself as a person, and as a president
all the time?
Yeah, he's not a candidate anymore, he's a president. So there's a stature he has to have, and himself, Emmanuel Macron, should not center stage. The president Macron should be center stage. Emmanuel Macron should be just a little behind.
Let's turn to the far right, because the Front National was meeting today to discuss a sort of a way back after the poor results they've had in elections.
Well, the poor results, I mean, that's something that's a bit not too poor. They were in the second round, and so that's not
but
such
only,
a poor
result.
But I
think they only get 8 seats in the parliamentary election.
Oh, yes, for the legislative election, yeah, they had poor results. Yes, but I mean, it was quite significant that they were the second party of France during the second round in France. I mean, it was Front National against Macron. It was not, you know, the Républicain or the Socialist Party. The Front National beaten all the or ancient and mainstream parties to be in the second round. So, and it's true that at the end of the second round, they were a bit bruised because they did a good first round, but there was this infamous debate, Marine Le Pen against Emmanuel Macron, and she completely ruined it. And then that's partly why she had such a bad score. It's not why she lost the election, but it's certainly why she has such a bad score.
And one of the things she's talked about is even changing the party's name.
Yes, and after that, she decided that there was something very important to be done even before the legislative election. There was no time between the presidential and the legislative to change the party completely. She had to make go with what she had. But after the debate, the party realized there's something wrong because we are standing on two legs who are going in two different directions. One is the identity part of the party. People want to say French identity, French first and all that. And the other one is the sovereignty. And that's very much to do with the euro. And some people in the party want to lose the euro, to quit the euro, even though it's shooting yourself in the foot in terms of the economy and this kind of thing. And these two very important parts inside the Front National, Marine Le Pen tried to reconcile them, but we saw during the debate that it was impossible. She didn't have not the intelligence, but she couldn't reconcile the two and seemed to be a credible politician. So she said, we have to figure out something. Are we more towards identity or more sovereignty? And that's what they are discussing at the moment. And you're right, it's not just the policy and the grand idea of the Front National. It's the core identity of the party this time. Front National is a name who's been very much attached to her father, her infamous father, in a way. She wants to distance herself from him. During the campaign, Front National was not big in
getting
the
rid of the name permanently might well be the way to do it.
Yeah, it was Marine Le Pen and La France Bleu Marine. Front National was very much behind because it has this old racist idea that Jean-Marie Le Pen put into the party. And yeah, changing a name would change a lot of things. It would basically brush up the image of the party. And she being still a new enough president of the party, she might be able to pull it off.
Marie, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for coming in. The journalist Marie Bion here in the studio. You're with Monocle 24. Now, the cinema show here on Monocle 24 has a little bite-sized spin-off called Action, which each week meets some of the people behind all facets of the cinema experience. Well, Tom Ford's fashion pedigree shines through his film work. His debut as Single Man was in 2009. Last year, he returned with the thriller Nocturnal Animals, which contrasted a nightmarish vision of Texas with LA's elite art scene. Well, working alongside one of the world's leading names in luxury design was a fascinating prospect for the production designer, Shane Valentino. Here, he explains how his work on Nocturnal Animals reflects the inner torment taking place inside the minds of the characters.
The way for me to maybe kind of answer that in the most direct way I can is to sort of speak about Amy Adams' character in Nocturnal Animals. And, you know, I always felt that character, when we sort of first got introduced to her, there's a sort of a coolness to her. It's almost as if she's sort of cut off emotionally from the rest of the world. She's a bit isolated in a lot of ways, you know, socioeconomically, because she exists in this world that is of the elite in terms of the financial elite, and then also in terms of the world in which she inhabits in terms of art.
The world inhabited by Amy Adams' character is almost an extension of the high-end gallery in which she spends most of her working hours. And in shaping that world, Shane Valentino took part of his inspiration from another master of the craft.
So I think, you know, like the way I started was it started invoking the films of Antonioni, you know, and I sort of looked at like Red Desert and the way in which he sort of was dealing with Monica Vitti in Red Desert, right? And sort of, and how he did that spatially. The way in which he did that was, you know, there was a way in which he shot her in which she's almost like frames within frames. It's almost as if she's captured by her own environment. Not to say that it's always like a sort of a prison cell, but what you can see in Amy Adams' environment is that it very much feels that way. There's these long corridors. Her stature is very diminutive in terms of the relationship to the space. It makes it feel like she is not very connected to her environment.
The relationship to one's surroundings is surely close to the heart of any designer. But in the case of this film, Shane Valentino found himself working alongside one of the world's leading design minds, a force of the fashion world who made the kind of leap into filmmaking that no one suspected.
you know, when I was having these conversations with Tom, I think, you know, we were always feeling that she has, in, you know, parentheses, a very curated space, right? She is, as a gallery owner, is actually very, is considered and considering the objects at all time. And so everything around her has to have a certain type of meaning and placement. And so that was the way in which we sort of entered that character. And so then when she has this kind of fissure in her world, when she gets the Nocturnal Animals document from Edward, that's where you can see some kind of transformation.
Navigating the landscape set before us in Nocturnal Animals is at times a fairly tricky business. With two narratives running in parallel, it can be easy to miss how one relates to the other. It's only through the precise illustration of these two worlds that we get a clear picture of both, and much of that is down to the relationship Shane formed with Tom Ford.
Tom is very charming and intelligent, and, you know, most people know that, but he's very funny as well. And it was that sort of entrance into his personality that it became very easy for me to sort of work with him. And, you know, because I think that people could say, oh, it's very intimidating to work with someone of his stature and his, like, sort of design stature. But, you know, I always go into these things as I, you know, we want to come together and collaborate on trying to articulate his vision the best way we can. His intelligence is so broad in terms of art and photography and architecture that and film, that it was very easy to have these conversations with him about these reference points. Because once you have those shared reference points, it's very easy to sort of talk about how these spaces should feel and how they should work.
And that was the production designer Shane Valentino recording his experience working on Tom Ford's film Nocturnal Animals. And now you can download the full 30-minute edition of The Cinema Show for a special tour of the Egyptian Theatre in Los Angeles, the scene of the very first Hollywood film premiere in 1922. This is The Monocle Daily. Next up, we'll take a look at some of the big stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
We turn our attention to India now to look at some of the stories making headlines there. Our guest in the studio, Sunath Batabail, who is a lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS here in London. Thank you very much for coming in this evening.
Good evening.
To talk about, but firstly, this increasingly alarming standoff that's developing between India and China.
Yeah, it started in June and it's been more than a month. And when it started, no one really expected, not in India, at least in the government sources, that it'll escalate to conversations about war and coming in from the official agency, press agency in China now talking about war. So this is quite serious. I mean, along with the defense ministry in India, the other ministry which will be very worried is the External Affairs Ministry. And it has to wonder why India has no friendly neighbors. You know, it's, India is just surrounded by countries hostile to her. That is one. Second, there's something quite interesting the government agency in China is saying. They're saying India must ask herself, who is setting up India and China as enemies, as competitors? It's the West. And they're saying that, look, if India and China go to war, the two biggest nations, supposedly, you know, the sleeping elephant and this leaping huge tiger, the economic ripple which will go through the world markets is immense. Asia will certainly lose. So I think it is also very sage advice, which I felt coming from China, that, look, this is a myth which has been set up that India and China are in competition to each other. They are not. They're neighbors. India is way behind in GDP, in defense spending, in a, except for perhaps competing on population and India is supposed to take over. They're not really anywhere close. So India has to take note of where it wants to escalate this conversation to. They are very worried. This is not a proxy war which they have been fighting with Pakistan for ages. This is very serious.
The problem, of course, is that issue of national pride. Once you get into these arguments, you then start to get this issue of sort of national pride. You don't want to be seen to be, you know, bending the knee to China, and that can find you talking yourself into a situation you can't easily step back from.
You're absolutely correct. And with a nationalist government like the Modi government, which kind of relies on machismo and talking itself up, and India and pride and ancient religion and civilization, all of this, it has suddenly found itself. And, you know, they're trying to tone down the rhetoric. Sushma Swaraj, the External Affairs Minister, is already talking about international support. They don't want to go this alone. You know, Pakistan, every time the talk is, why don't we nuke out the country? The conversation is very muted in India. But they of course, have to be careful, because the Modi, the prime ministerial image, is built on a chest of 56 inches, as the man likes to put. But this is a dangerous face. Also, you have to remember, about 3 weeks back when Modi met Trump, it was a conversation apparently amongst friends, and Trump named Pakistan as a difficult country. So setting India up again. But Trump is a fair weather friend. You know, he'll suddenly find it's very unreliable that America might not go all the way to support India, and it's been a difficult relationship when it comes to China.
Let's move on to another story. This is rather fascinating. Airbnb. There are all sorts of issues around Airbnb, but in India in particular, some people are refusing to accept couples if they're not married.
It's an interesting one. First of all, to be very clear, there are no legal issues involved in hosting unmarried couples. In the Supreme Court, viewpoint is, heterosexual unmarried couples, if there's no adultery, there's no criminal offense involved. So if anyone in India is talking about a legal problem, that's not true. The problem is on many other levels. It's a cultural problem, which is cultural problem. The state intervenes in very unlawful ways. You know, you'll regularly find police raiding hotels across the country, raiding rooms where unmarried couples have taken up, asking for bribes, asking for fines. So that is one problem. The other problem is the vigilante crowd, which goes around cities and small towns, checking relationships between man and woman who are not married. That is one. Third is, in small towns across India, as I say, tongues wag, and people will find themselves in difficult situations if rooms are given out because it's not culturally appropriate. So Airbnb has a whole host of issues to consider in India. You know, and it's not an unique one. In America, you'll find race problems which come up. In a certain people of different colors and religion and ethnic origin will not be given rooms. So in India, this is I want to see, you know, this is an interesting
it's
one.
It's a different type of discrimination to the ones Airbnb facing in the country.
Absolutely, and a very much more complicated one. It's not, if I may say, black and white here. You know, this will be a very kind of troubling space which Airbnb will find itself. And this is new. Whole host of issues will come up in India.
Lastly, anybody who has traveled on a British train, I mean, at any time ever, we'll have some sympathy with this. Indian Railways food is not really up to scratch, to say the least.
Yes, you know, you throw me off by saying British Rail, because the food, comparably, I would rather have an Indian tandoori and roti rather than the stale sandwich. But it's a huge problem. Again, just because of the sheer scale of Indian Railways. It's the largest employer in India. Millions travel every day, right? The problem is not government. The problem here is efficiency in and outsourcing to private companies, which has happened in the last 10, 15 years. The top-notch rails, which travel especially from Delhi and Mumbai and the big cities, have outsourced to contractors. And the contractors have one motive, that's profit. And there you go. And a whole can of worms open up. And a can of worms is probably the wrong way to end this.
Food. It is the same story the world over, though, isn't it? It is. It'll be much cheaper if we get these other chaps in to do the food. And then, funnily enough, it turns out the way they can do it for cheaper is by making rubbish food.
And here is where I differ with you. Now, if you travel on Indian railways, mostly the food is great. The problem is the cockroach and the rat which just swings by suddenly past you, right, as you're having your food. It's the unhygienic quality. And it's not only the cooking. You'll find dustbins which have not been emptied or which doesn't have proper lids on top. You'll find water which is not filtered or not bottled properly with which food is being cooked. The meal itself, I have no issues with. I have been traveling for 20 years on Indian
railways. It's just the after effects.
Yes, you're right.
You paint a pretty picture of Indian railway cuisine, and there I'm afraid we'll have to leave it. Somnath Bhattabhar, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Now, if you are a regular viewer of Game of Thrones, you are doubtless thrilled senseless by its return. If, like me, you have never seen it, you are doubtless sick and tired of hearing about it. But you would probably still assume that any other programme that its creators could come up with would be greeted with similar rapture. Not so for Confederate, the latest high-profile HBO drama to be set in a dark alternate reality. Well, joining me on the line now is Walter Allen, who is a professor of education, sociology and African American studies at UCLA. Thank you very much for your time this evening. So the premise of this new program is it's set in an alternate America where the southern states secede from the Union, slavery continues to the present day. That is clearly going to be a very controversial area to get into.
It definitely is so. I think the creators recognize that, and when they refer to the concept as weapons-grade material.
Now, in a way, it seems sort of well-timed. There are so many debates in America about race, about issues related to race, and there are plenty of reminders of America's past that pop up in the news. So, in a way, it's kind of almost a well-timed thing, yet some people are very nervous about how the people behind Game of Thrones will handle it.
And I think those competing responses illustrate the moment we're in the U.S. as regards race. Obviously, on one side, there is great concern and trepidation about the timing, about the subject matter, as well as just timing. And on the other side are those who think that it is opportune and an opportune moment. Ultimately, the test will be how the material is presented and how the creators address what is a very painful and ugly part of American history and a part of American history that is still very much influencing our present as regards race and racial relationships and the status of blacks in this society.
Now, issues around slavery have been handled on TV before, most famously in Roots, which at its time, I think, was the most popular American drama serial that ever been. But still, it is a very controversial issue. Roots was credited at the time for bringing home to white America the reality of slavery and why it was still such a powerful sting for so many people in America. Is there a chance that, well made, this new program could do the same thing for another generation?
I hesitate to presume that the two would be on an equal par. I am, however, inclined to accept at least the basis of your premise that this new series, depending on how it's done, and even, frankly, the mere fact that it would be launched, will raise some important debates about slavery, about race, and will have us revisit and wrestle with those issues anew. Ideally and wonderfully, it would be the case if, indeed, this new series has the level of seriousness and thoughtful consideration of slavery and grounds it in the reality of the society to the same extent that Roots did. I have a hunch it'll be fabulously successful, and certainly initially, just given the explosiveness of the subject matter.
And certainly that there is a real appetite in America and in many other countries too at the moment for these type of dramas. We've had things like The Handmaid's Tale or The Man in the High Castle, which are other sort of dystopian stories that have been turned into television programs. Now this one, though, as you say, this one needs to be handled so sensitively because of all the issues that that will chime with things that are happening today in America.
I think very much so. And as my position evolves, I am absolutely inclined to defend the rights of the creators to move in this direction and to offer this particular production, because one should not be in the business of policing thoughts, but at the same time, those who produce that kind of creative product are to be held accountable and must be responsible for what it is that they are putting out there.
Professor Walter Allen from UCLA, thank you very much for your time this evening. And that is it for this edition of the Monocle Daily. It was produced by Ben Ryland. Our researchers were Paige Reynolds and Helena Jarrett, and our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. From 8 o'clock, our London time on Saturday morning, it'll be the weekend edition. Now, for a long time, Sampha's voice was something that was mostly heard featured in other songs from other artists like Drake or Kanye West. His debut album this year is called Process and has received huge acclaim, with a sweet and sensitive treatment of some, at times, fairly dark topics. So tonight, we will leave you with this track from the album. It's called No One Knows Me Like the Piano. From me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
No one knows me like the piano in my mother's home.